Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad you could join me as we dive into the big collection of baseball cards from our past and perhaps our present, and hopefully the future if we keep the hobby going, talking about some cardboard gods from our collections. Even if you don't collect today, it's always good to just kind of go through the old boxes and see what you once thought you could pay off your student loans with. Now, if you have a large collection of 1956 Topps cards, perhaps you could start making some down payments on some overdue bills, as the 56 Topps set is one of the most prized. It is one of the most artistic, one of the most beautiful sets that Topps made, not only in the 50s, but certainly in their entire 67-year history. You could argue that it is their best set, and we'll talk in depth about the 56 Topps set. We'll also talk about some of the players that are in my collection of 56 Topps cards, which is a small collection, but some very interesting stories from some of the dollar bin commons that I was able to pick up at recent card shows. And we'll also talk a little bit about a very interesting 56 Topps card, that, of course, the Henry Aaron card starring Willie Mays. Yes, one of the most underrated but thoroughly appreciated uncorrected error cards from the 1956 Topps set. We'll also have a little sidebar on the Cincinnati Redlegs, because I've got a couple of the cards that are of Redlegs players, and a nice reminder about political turmoil of a different type in this nation more than 60 years ago. Now, before we talk a little bit about the 56 Topps set, I want to remind you that Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday. We're doing this during the playoffs and into the off season. We'll see how well the show trends by giving everybody a chance to breathe. Ever since we came back from our extended rain delay in July, we've had a lot of great commentary, a lot of people excited that we're back, but also a lot of shows, and we need for you to catch up with some of the old programs, which you can do on our archive via Audioboom and also all of our other platforms, as the new and old shows come your way on Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify. Basically, wherever there's a way to get a podcast, if you type in the name Wax Ecstatic, chances are you will find us there. We're just kind of that lurking podcast. Just when you think we've gone away, we haven't. Well, at least not yet, but there's always time, right? So Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday now, so our next new show will be coming out on November 2nd. We will be doing another pack break on the October 29th. That's a Monday. I will post a poll on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and we will offer up three options for our fans to choose from. And of those three options, the top vote getter will be opened up. I've got some packs from the early 80s, some cello, some wax, some rack packs, and we'll just put them all out there and see which ones you want opened up. We'll pick that pack that you select. We'll open it up. We'll talk about the particular set and also whatever cards we pull out of that pack. So mark your calendar, put something in your Outlook planner, if you will. Again, Monday, October 29th, we'll have the next poll up. On November the 1st, that's a Thursday, we will have the video of the break up there to kind of get you ready for the show, which again will come out a brand new one for you on November 2nd. Now, Wax Ecstatic is also looking for any financial support. I don't do this for my health, and I certainly don't do this to get rich, but any cash donations via our PayPal account, paypal.me/waxecstatic, are greatly appreciated, as the money that is raised through those donations go to two purposes. One, to maintain our home base at Audioboom and the archives that get spread out to all the other platforms, but also to help us purchase packs that are slightly more entertaining for us to open up every other show that we do the pack openings. So nothing wrong with the 87 Tops solo pack or the occasional 88 Fleer pack, but we do want to have the opportunity to place bids and make some purchases for some earlier 80s stuff and hopefully some late 70s stuff. Still looking for that right deal. Haven't had the time to do it just yet. Plus, I've got a little bit of a backlog of some really good packs that we're going to put up in our next auction. So again, paypal.me/waxecstatic, that is the way to go to get your donations. If you've already donated, thank you again for doing so. If you haven't yet, if you got a few extra bucks in your pocket, again, we're not looking to raise $500 here, although I won't turn it down. But if we get, even if it's a $5 or $10 donation, that goes a long, long way in keeping this show going. Now let's go into 1956 Tops here. It's a great set, and I've been talking about this for a while. This was one of the two sets that I did not have from the mid-50s for a very long time. I finally bridged that gap with some purchases from the dollar box, or the half-off box, I guess you could say, at a local card show. And as I've mentioned before, I'm really not a big stickler about the condition that these cards are in. So some of these cards have rounded corners. Some of them have creases. One, in fact, we'll be talking about a Johnny Schmitz card, which is a high number card in this set too, is in almost mint condition, slightly off center. And then you turn the card around, and you know whoever owned it when he was a kid wrote the number 14 on the back. So that took the card from probably around an $80 or $90 value down to, well, I think I purchased it for a dollar at the show, although that's still a bargain because even with the handwriting on it, you could say it's still worth $7 or $8. But anyways, I'm not a big stickler on the condition of these cards, but I'm so glad that I did manage to pick up a few. And hopefully as time goes on, I'll be able to pick up some more and maybe some star cards to add to the collection. But for me personally, now my collection goes back to 1949 with some Bowman cards, and we are moving through the 1950s. So I am proud to say, thanks to the urging on of some of our fans, I've been able to take some of these gaps in my collection and fill them. So if you look through the archives, the history of Wax Ecstatic, you will see that we've got you covered going from 1949 all the way up through 1993 in the 118 shows that we've done. So if you're just looking for an in-depth look at certain sets or maybe some players from sets, we've got it for you, all covered over the last few years in this show. So for those of you who are fans of vintage cards, thank you for your patience. And yes, you did push me to finally get around to buying a few cards here. And it's been a lot of fun to pick up some really good bargains and really more to hear some of the great stories of these cards. So let's talk about the 56 Tops set. As I mentioned in our show on 55 Tops a few weeks ago, it's funny how in America's mind, the 1950s seem to start in 1955, and there's a number of reasons that I covered. One is you had the post-war adulation of winning the war along with the Allied powers, but there was a post-war recession. There were several years of everybody getting back on their feet. Then you had the Korean War in the early 1950s. You had McCarthyism going on. You started to have the tables turn in terms of equal rights, and you know, all of a sudden, there's a little bit of turbulence going on in the society of America. Well, in 1955, you have the beginning of rock and roll, you know, becoming mainstream music. You have the beginning of the demographic called the teenager, as the baby boomers were moving into, you know, their teen years. All of a sudden that became a marketing group, basically a group that was targeted, the next generation that is still heavily sought after by advertisers is the teenage group. So that started around 1955. You had some watershed movies come along. I mentioned Rebel Without a Cause. Also, Blackboard Jungle, another one. That movie soundtrack with Bill Haley and the Comets, Rock Around the Clock, the first rock song to hit number one on the pop music charts, and they can kind of start that domino or the dominoes falling in terms of making rock music just kind of this loud, noisy thing that kids did into mainstream. And the economy's better. The cars with the big tail fins come back. So that's all part of it. But also our revisionist history, whenever there's a movie or a TV show that is set in the 1950s, it always seems to be 55, 55, 56, 57. So we're talking Happy Days. We're talking American Graffiti. You know, that's the type of stuff. You know, you never really set a movie in 1952 or something like that. Back to the Future, another one. You know, it always seems to just start at 1955 and move forward. And it's interesting because we remember the mid-50s as these glory days when, in reality, the mid to late 50s were anything but glory days. In fact, bubbling underneath the surface was a lot of the tumult that would show up in the 1960s. So there is a little bit of a revisionist history that goes on over time. And I find it very interesting how, you know, things were not all peaches and cream in the mid to late 50s, but we seem to remember it that way. And one way we remember that is with baseball cards, and we remember that with the great product that Topps put out in 1956. And what made it great was not only just the content that was on this cardboard, but also the fact that Topps really didn't need to do this. 1956 marks several beginnings in the baseball card hobby, but also marks the end of a few trends in the baseball card hobby. One thing that ended was the bloody battle between Topps and Bowman for baseball card supremacy. J. William Bowman, the founder of the Bowman Baseball Cards and the Gum Ink Company, we told you a little bit about him when we did our early 50s Bowman podcast a few months back. Well, he sells Bowman to a company in 1953, and the company just had no financial deep pockets to withstand round after round, battle after battle in this war with Topps. For 5 or 6 years, Topps and Bowman are just beating each other's heads in court, one suing the other for, you know, copyright infringement and, you know, signing players to exclusive contracts and who had the right to, you know, package certain things within the packs of gum. It just went back and forth and on and on and on. And it truly was a war of attrition. Topps finally just ground Bowman into the dirt. Despite Bowman's best efforts to create some really nice cards, they just couldn't keep up with Topps over the years. So finally, the war ends after 1955's baseball season. Topps buys Bowman out. Bowman becomes intellectual property of the Topps Chewing Gum Company, would not see the light of day again until 1989. And, oh, by the way, with Topps basically killing Bowman here, Topps would have the sole run at the baseball card industry for 25 years. Now, I should clarify, that's the sole run in terms of having the exclusivity and the approval of baseball cards by both Major League Baseball and the Players Association. Other companies, notably Fleer, would produce baseball cards, but they weren't officially licensed or officially recognized, I should say, because this is still kind of in the early years of licensing, so to speak, before the Players Association came around in the mid-60s. But there was only one truly recognized, quote-unquote, official baseball card, and that was Topps for 25 years. So Fleer would put out, you know, a day in the life of Ted Williams, and they would produce this, you know, 60-card set of some pretty boring moments in an average day of Ted Williams' life. But it wasn't an official card set. They couldn't use the Boston Red Sox when describing Ted Williams. They couldn't put a Boston Red Sox logo. You couldn't picture the Red Sox word type if you had Ted Williams wearing the Red Sox uniform. So there are all sorts of restrictions, and basically any competition to what Topps put out over the next 25 years was half-baked, with the exception of the 1963 Fleer set, which Fleer said, damn the Torpedoes, we're putting out this set, and Topps dropped the hammer and basically limited the Fleer set to only one series of 110 cards before they won that court battle as well. So it's the end of a bloody battle between Topps and Bowman that lasted for years. It's the beginning of a 25-year monopoly until Topps loses in court, and that opens the door for Fleer and Donruss in 1981 to start producing officially licensed baseball cards and other merchandise. And then it is also the end of the big card, the 1957 set would shift to the 2.5-inch by 3.5-inch card size. So much to the delight of collectors today, you don't have to buy too many oversized plastic pages to hold your vintage cards. But that's actually kind of a good thing, because that would set the standard that is still used to this day in the baseball card industry, having 2.5-inch by 5 or 3.5-inch cards instead of the slightly larger sizes that you saw Topps come out with in 1952 and run with for the next several years. Now, the 56 Topps set is the largest set that Topps put out because they now had control of all the exclusive player contracts. A 340 card set, that's 340 numbered cards. There were two unnumbered checklists, and that brings in the dawn of the checklist card, which even though some collectors could care less about the checklist card, I always like, if I can get a good condition checklist card from an older set, I'll actually buy it, because, you know, checklist cards were actually used for checklist purposes back in the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s. You know, kids would get those cards, they'd set them aside, and then they would actually check them off as they were completing sets. So getting a mint condition a checklist card is actually very unusual, although the checklist cards in the mid-50s were very nondescript. By the 1960s, Topps would dress them up a little bit by putting pictures of some star players alongside the checklist itself. Also, speaking of checklists, you had the team photo cards come out in 1956, so that was a neat way for fans to see the entire team together, as opposed to a selection of 12 to 14 players on each team that stood out. So that was another addition that you saw, another beginning in 1956. And you also saw the beginning of an effort by Topps to not only own the baseball card industry, if you will, but put out some really great products. And because Topps killed off Bowman in 1956, Topps could have mailed it in. In fact, they could have done it for the next 25 years, and they never did. I think it's really something when you see, when you look at the sets from 1956 to 1979, even some of the not as popular sets from that era, still Topps went out of their way to make something that not only gave them a reason to be the only game in town for many, many years, but also really helped them fulfill the standard that they set of making baseball cards that represented the time period, that looked like it belonged in that particular year. And you especially look at some of the really colorful sets from the 1970s. That really represents the 70s. Some of the button-down sets of the mid-60s, or some of the really fun-looking sets of the early 60s. And, of course, as we've discussed in looking at 1958 and 59 Topps in particular, very colorful sets, too, with the color palette of Madison Avenue at that time. So Topps could have just said, well, we've killed off the competition, we're the only game in town, we're the only recognized card set that's out there, let's just print a bunch of pictures and put them out there. Hats off to Topps for never doing that. Like I said, even some of the sets, and there were a few over the next 25 years, but for the most part, Topps would put out sets that not only represented the time, but still went out to find the best rookie stars, to highlight the big stars that were in the game, and to have some pretty innovative designs throughout the years, many which still have, you know, withstood the test of time and are still very, very popular to this day. The 1956 set is definitely one of those sets. 1955 Topps was an outstanding set, yet Topps went above and beyond in 1956. You could argue that the use of the picture-in-picture, having that posed picture, the mugshot, if you will, the up-close facial shot of a player with the action shot in the background and a true action shot, not just, you know, a guy, swinging a bat, but you have the guy swinging the bat at home plate. You know, it's an actual action shot from a game or from a pregame warm-up that was colorized by Topps, and it's a great work of art, taking that very popular picture-in-picture look, which they had used not only in 55 but also 1954, and turning it into a Renoir. I mean, just an incredible piece of artwork. Card after card in this 1956 set. Now, I've mentioned before that some of my favorite sets personally include 65 Topps. I also like 87 Topps, 77 Topps, 1953 Topps as well as a great set. But 1956 is right up there. And you could really make a case that Topps created the best set in 1956. I've heard some people say that, you know, it's better than 53 or it's better than 87, which is a fan favorite for many, many collectors. Or it's better than, you know, say, a 55 set or the 52 set. Of course, you've got the mantle card in 52 that everyone still chases after. But in terms of star power, in terms of art, in terms of just the overall design, 56 Topps takes the cake in a lot of polls. If you were to do just a random poll of 100 collectors, you're going to find quite a few people who put 56 Topps at the very top of the list. Now, one thing that I didn't laud 56 Topps about is the rookies. There's really no huge rookie card like there is in the 55 set. Luis Aparicio is really the one big rookie card there, but that's okay because, again, without Bowman as competition, Topps had all the big names here. So Mickey Mantle is back in the set. You've got Ted Williams. You've got all the big stars, Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and Ernie Banks, you know, all these other great players from this time period. They're all right there in this set. Roberto Clemente as well. Just so many awesome players from, as many people will say, a golden era of baseball, all in this one set. And they look great with, you know, the artwork and, you know, the utilization of the picture-in-picture. So that's the front of the card. The back of the card, also very interesting. The low number set, or the early series set, 1 through 110, features a mix of white stock and gray cardboard stock. And then the higher series cards, it's all gray cardboard stock. Collectors tend to lean towards collecting the gray cardboard stock, but what that does at the very least is provide collectors with yet another version of cards to go out and buy. So 56 Topps can be an adventure, sometimes a frustrating one. If you try to pick up every variation of card, it's going to take you a while, cost you a few bucks as well, but that's one of those chases that some collectors do, trying to get the gray and the white parallel, if you will, of some of those lower number cards. Also, the backs of the cards feature the stats from the previous season, also career stats, fielding stats off to the side, and something that I think is very emblematic of the time, the three-panel cartoon, which was very popular with Topps in the mid-1950s. Topps basically covers roughly two-thirds of the back of each card with the color comic panels. And I think that's an ode to shifting consumption, you know, media consumption habits of Americans in the mid-1950s. As I mentioned in the 1955 Topps podcast, with television becoming so big, you saw a lot more visual effects being worked into print publications and even things like baseball cards. So when you go back and you look at cards from, say, 1952, if you look at the back of a 52 Topps card, yeah, you'll have stats there, but you also have a lot of narrative, a lot of words. Well, with 56 Topps, you've got stats, you've got personal information, you know, height, weight, birth date, stuff like that. But the cartoon isn't just this kind of side trivia thing. It's a three-panel piece that tells the whole story. And I think, again, that's a nod to television consumption in America in 1956. Movies as well. You know, movie theaters had to answer television. And, you know, movie theaters were coming out with surround sound stereo, more color films, CinemaScope presentations. You know, they had to come up with all sorts of bells and whistles to get people out to the movie theaters and not just stay at home and watch everything on the new television set. So America was becoming more and more of a visual stimulated nation and society. And you definitely see that on the back of the 56 Topps cards. Topps also employing a lot of the red, the black, slight touch of green in the back of cards, something that we mentioned in the 1955 Topps set. That was a color combination, very popular with Topps throughout the mid to late 1950s and going into the early 1960s. So 1956 Topps, like I said, it doesn't have the big rookie names that some of the 55 sets or the 55 set had, but it does have all the star players and basically anybody who was good enough to have a baseball card. They're featured in 56 Topps with an award-winning design, in my opinion, a very interesting layout on the back of cards, and just a fun set to collect. Like I said, if you try to go out and get every variation, it will cost you a lot. If you're going to put down money for a Clemente or a Mantle or a Williams or whomever, those cards will run you a few hundred bucks a pop if they're in mint condition. But if you're not big on worrying about condition of cards and you just want to go out there and collect as many as you can, there are good deals to be had. You can find lots of common cards in decent condition on eBay for basically $3 to $4 a card. Or like myself, if you're lucky enough, you may find a card dealer who, you know, he or she, they don't make the money on even vintage cards, and especially the beat up ones. They'll put it in a dollar box, or, you know, some of the cards that are in better condition or bigger star names, you may be able to get for $3, $4, $5 a pop. That is not a bad deal for a legendary set. So the next card show you're at, or the next time you're browsing around eBay or some other auction site, if you're looking for 1956 Topps cards, they are out there. They're not always in gem mint condition, but you can still find some that are in decent shape for a decent price. And I highly, highly recommend getting your hands on some of them. First of all, just because I'm a big fan of history and baseball history and old baseball cards, so why not? But also get your hands on them because they really, truly are works of art, just absolute things of beauty. A couple other notes on 56 Topps. First of all, I mentioned that there weren't any big rookie cards in there, and in fact, Topps really goofed in 1956 by not having Frank Robinson, the rookie of the year, in this set. He would not make his rookie card appearance until 1957. So that is one bit of a goof up there. Another goof up, which was pointed out by one of our listeners, Heavy J. He asked this question on Twitter. He said, is it true that the Henry Aaron card features an action shot of Willie Mays? Well, Heavy J, the answer is yes, you are correct. It's not just a rumor. If you take a close look at the Henry Aaron card, first of all, you'll notice that the 56 Topps mugshot of Henry Aaron is the exact same as the 55 Topps. Topps was very, very smart in reusing some pictures throughout the 1956 set. And they managed to basically reuse every mugshot for each card. And we point this out in our video link from yesterday with Jim Rivera and Jim Hegan by pure chance, because I really wasn't paying attention to the cards that I was pulling out of this dollar box. I was just looking more at condition and trying to get a, you know, because I was going to drop $50 or $60 on these common cards, just trying to find a fair balance of these early to mid-1950s sets. I didn't notice that I had pulled a Jim Hegan and a Jim Rivera card from both 55 and 56 Topps. But if you look at both of them together, you will see that the shot in the foreground, again, that mugshot, as I call it, they were utilized in both sets. So a very efficient operation from Topps here in 1956. The same thing with Henry Aaron. You've got the same foreground shot. But if you look very closely at the action shot, it is clearly not Henry Aaron. And it has been confirmed that that is an action shot of the Say Hey Kid, Willie Mays. Now, what's interesting is I've done a lot of research, gone through some photo archives with the Associated Press, with Getty Images, even just a random Google search. I cannot find one specific dead-on photo of Willie Mays sliding into home base that or home plate, I should say, sliding into home that Topps took and dummied up to make it look like Henry Aaron. I have found one, and I will share this in our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. I have found one from 1952 that is very close. If you compare the two images side by side, you will see that the action photo that I found from 1952 appears to be maybe half a second before the action shot that was utilized on this 56 Topps card. And that's assuming that this is the exact same play. But like I said, I couldn't find the exact dead-on photo where I could say, ah, that's what Topps was using. So I found one that is very close and is interesting to see if it was the inspiration for the action shot. I actually, in our conversation on Wax and Gum Stains, tried to loop in Keith Olbermann, who's the expert on Topps baseball cards history. He didn't take the bait, though, so unfortunately we couldn't get any answer from him. But I think I found a picture that is close and is tantalizing to think that perhaps it was the inspiration for this uncorrected error. Now, why would Topps do this? Well, I can think of a couple of reasons. One is they probably just didn't have a good action photo of Henry Aaron hanging around. Now, keep in mind, even though Henry Aaron would be the home run king when all was said and done, in 1956, he and the Milwaukee Braves are still kind of off the radar. The Braves were turning into what would be a very dominant team in the late 1950s and probably could have been a lot better if they were able to financially make things work in Milwaukee before relocating to Atlanta. But still in 1956, other than, you know, being featured on, you know, the first edition of Sports Illustrated and, yeah, being on the nation's conscience, it was still Milwaukee. And Henry Aaron wasn't, you know, hammering Hank Aaron like we know today. This was still the time of the Yankees. And you're still talking about Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford and Yogi Berra and all the great Yankees of the mid-1950s, and, you know, you had the Yankees and the Dodgers going back and forth, and, you know, everything was still very much focused on New York at this point in time. So perhaps the photographer wasn't dispatched to Milwaukee enough. Maybe whatever photos they had just really weren't good quality. Or, and I hate to say this, but again, it's 1956. When they're assembling these cards together, it may have just been a situation of, hey, we don't have an action shot of Henry Aaron. And you may have had some art director go, well, let's just find a picture of another black guy and we'll just paint a Braves jersey on him and go from there. Like I said, I hate to say it, but it was 1956. That may have just been the mindset. Well, find another picture of another dark player and we'll make it work. Because even though there were a lot of great advances in getting African Americans involved in the game at the major league level by 1956, still, there was a very small number of black players playing in the big leagues. In fact, the big leagues still were not completely integrated. You were still 3 years away from that finally happening when the Boston Red Sox, as a token of good faith, finally offered a contract to Pumpsy Green, and finally every team had a player of color on their roster. So that may have been it. I don't know. Again, you're going back now 62 years in history, and a lot of the people who would have been at the heart of making those decisions for Topps, unfortunately, many have passed, or they just weren't, you know, it just didn't stick out. There wasn't any great reason for using a Willie Mays picture, painting up the picture to look like a Braves jersey, and calling him Henry Aaron. But it is true, Heavy J, you did not hear incorrectly. The Henry Aaron card features an action shot of Willie Mays sliding into home plate. I have yet to find the definitive photograph from that particular moment in time that Topps used, but I found something very similar from 1952 that perhaps could have inspired that particular picture. And again, look in our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Over the next few days, we'll post those side by side, and you be the judge. Now, one other interesting note, a couple of the cards that I have from this collection feature the Cincinnati Ball Club, which in 1956 was called the Cincinnati Red Legs. And a lot of you already know the story of the Red Legs, but if you don't know, the Cincinnati Reds, who started as the Cincinnati Red Stockings in 1869, they kind of inadvertently got caught up in McCarthyism in the late 40s and early 50s. Senator Joe McCarthy of Wisconsin was on this tirade. Many people now, all these years later, will look back at it and say it truly was a witch hunt. Anybody who had any kind of sympathy towards communism or had some kind of communist traits, or as time would tell, just somebody who maybe knew somebody who had a Russian last name, McCarthy would call them out on the carpet, and there was this huge scare, the Red Scare of the 1950s, where everybody was afraid that somebody living in their neighborhood was actually a communist and was somehow, you know, not sympathetic to the United States and was, you know, getting information to the Soviets in particular. And it was an interesting time because the Red Scare started right before the Korean War. And of course, one factor in the Korean War was communist China backing the North Koreans in this battle. And China going to communism in 1947, Russia being communist at this point in time, and everybody was afraid of the domino theory. That's why America got involved in the war in Vietnam. Everybody thought, well, it's Russia, then China. Well, is French Indochina next? Is Vietnam next? And everybody thought that all of a sudden all of Asia was going to fall into the hands of communists, and then somehow we were going to live in a communist world. So this is all just playing at the height of conspiracy theories about all things communist. And here are the Cincinnati Reds. And, you know, a Red was a nickname, kind of a slur almost, for somebody who was of communist sympathies. And the baseball team in Cincinnati is like, well, we don't want to get caught up in this McCarthyism thing. So officially, from 1953 through 1959, the Reds were called the Red Legs. And that is where you also had a revival, albeit briefly, of the Red Stockings nickname. But also, you had the introduction of Mr. Red Leg, that, you know, it's almost like Mr. Met with a handlebar mustache, kind of running with a bat in his hand. It looks like he should be part of a barbershop quartet. You've seen a little bit of Mr. Red Leg come back you know, spots here and there in Cincinnati over the last few years. But, you know, the Reds were just for many years trying to get away from the Reds moniker, but they still incorporated it in their uniforms and the wishbone C. There was still Red Leg. They were sometimes still referred to as Reds, even though officially that wasn't their name. But it's a very interesting part of our history and part of our hysterical history, not ha-ha funny hysterical, but hysteria in our history, a dark time in American politics and society. Remember what I said about the 1950s not being all, you know, white bread and Leave It to Beaver. I mean, it was, there were some trying times, and, you know, like I said, there were a lot of people who, especially in the arts, whose lives and careers were ruined by McCarthyism and the rampant witch hunt of, you know, labeling anyone who may have sort of somewhat kind of had some kind of connection to Soviet sympathies. People's lives were ruined by people who just had to point a finger and cause a bit of a scare there. But that's one of the interesting things from our allotment of cards here from 1956. Now, there are some interesting stories about some of the players in the 1956 set. I've got 9 cards here. No real superstars. A few semi-stars, I would say. Quite a few all-star players here. But some great stories of players. And let me start off with Howie Pollitt. Or if you were to go by his French roots, you could call him Howie Pollet. But I love the story of Howie Pollitt. Born and raised in New Orleans, and according to the people at the Society for American Baseball Research, or SABR, his next-door neighbor growing up was the legendary Mel Parnell, the old southpaw for the Boston Red Sox. Well, Howie Pollitt was also a baseball star, a lefty as well. Growing up in New Orleans, was a stud in high school and American Legion ball. His father passed away when he was a teenager, so he's working at a local gas station just trying to help the family make ends meet. When the gas station owner reaches out to a buddy of his, a man named Eddie Dyer. Now, Dyer is also from Louisiana, is also a former big league pitcher, and at this point in time, he was named the manager for the Houston Buffaloes in 1939. And Dyer takes a look at Pollitt, likes what he sees, signs him to a deal, and Pollitt very quickly becomes a star for the Buffaloes, which was then a farm club for the St. Louis Cardinals. Just a couple of years later, he's fast-tracked right up into the big leagues, and he's an absolute star for the Cardinals in the early 1940s. In fact, in 1942, helped the Cardinals win a World Series. Then, like many other players at this time in history, goes overseas to serve in the military in World War II, comes back after the 1945 season, and is trying to kind of figure out, well, what am I going to do with my life? And says, let me get baseball a try again. So he reaches out to the Cardinals. Well, who is named the manager of the Cardinals for the 1946 season? You guessed it, Eddie Dyer. So Dyer goes ahead and gets him back on the team. Pollitt is moving into Houston. That's where Dyer is right now. So they became very close friends, and Dyer really depended on Pollitt. In fact, in 1946, when the Cardinals had a three-game playoff series with the Brooklyn Dodgers to determine the National League pennant, it was Dyer going to Pollitt for Game 1, and Pollitt pitched a gem in Game 1, which helped advance the Cardinals to the World Series, which they would beat the Red Sox in seven games that year. So he picks up his second World Series championship in 1946. Pollitt at this time is just a mere 25 years old. The world is his oyster. Well, he starts developing arm problems and is just never able to shake it. After the 1950 season, he gets dealt to the Pittsburgh Pirates. The Pirates are a perennial cellar dweller at this point in time. And then he bounces around a little bit too, and ends up his pro career in minor league ball. But that doesn't end his baseball career. Now, remember what I said, he and Dyer were good friends. So when his pro ball career ends, he starts working for Dyer's insurance company, and he gets back into the game as a pitching coach. In fact, he goes back to St. Louis. Another Houston resident, Solly Hemus, is the manager for the Cardinals, and Hemus picks Pollitt to be the pitching coach. And he was a big part of the Cardinals' rotation rounding into form in the early 60s. And he would win another World Series in 1964 when the Cardinals surprised the world, caught the Phillies in a thrilling pennant chase down to the very last day. And then the Cardinals go on to beat the Yankees in the 1964 World Series. Now, the Cardinals, because they were out of the race a few months before, Johnny Keene, who was the manager of the team at this point in time, had his eyes on another job, actually took the job with the Yankees in 1965. There was a big blow up with the whole Cardinals ownership and management and coaching staff. So despite winning a World Series in 64, Pollitt leaves the Cardinals, goes to Houston. He's the pitching coach for the Astros in 1965, and then he would end his coaching career. He would go back into insurance sales full-time after Eddie Dyer passed away in 1964. Pollitt was a part owner of this insurance agency, and he would continue to do so until his death from cancer in 1974. Now, a very interesting footnote to the life and times of the late Howie Pollitt. Pollitt is credited, according to the Sporting News, he was credited with something that is now just standard operating procedure, but in the day it was revolutionary: the pitch count. Now, he's not the first guy to count pitches, but he was the first pitching coach to utilize the pitch count, specifically in spring training, to determine when a pitcher has reached a limit and it's time to work somebody else into a spring training game or an exhibition game. So it was Howie Pollitt who started the trend in the late 1950s of utilizing the pitch count to determine the length of an appearance for a pitcher in spring training, and of course that would eventually find its way into games and is now just an absolute monster in Major League Baseball. Now, while Howie Pollitt was a big part of the Cardinals' pitching staff, the Cardinals in the early 50s were hoping that Ray Jablonski, a Chicago native, would become a big part of the lineup and an anchor at third base. The problem was Ray Jablonski was not a very good third baseman. He often coughed up balls and was just an error-prone hot corner. And despite the Cardinals' best efforts to make him into a steady third baseman, he just couldn't get the glove side down. So he would later go on to Cincinnati, where he is featured here with the Cincinnati Redlegs. Ray Jablonski was a power hitter, very consistent hitter, but like I said, just couldn't match the hitting with the glove. So that would cause him a lot of frustration with a lot of teams. He would bounce around from one team to another throughout his big league career as the frustrating third baseman. If you're a team and you can get a third baseman who can not only hit the ball, but also provide a gold glove worthy performance defensively, he's a keeper. And no matter the ups and downs, you hang on to that player for as long as you possibly can. You know, look at David Wright, you know, with the Mets. I mean, he's had so many health problems over the last few years, but still part of that organization. Evan Longoria with the Rays for, what was it, about 10 years. You know, he was the face of the franchise. No matter how good or bad the team was, no matter how good or bad Longoria had for a season, they knew that he had those tools, so they kept him for a long time. Unfortunately for Jablonski, that didn't work. And after his playing career wrapped up in the late 50s, he worked for a cardboard box company near Comiskey Park and was later promoted to a sales position there. And he was, you know, somebody who was very proud of his Polish heritage. And despite the fact that he couldn't have a lengthy major league career because of his defensive problems, he was very much involved in Polish communities, mostly in Chicago, but was also a key part of many St. Louis Cardinals old-timers games. Passed away in 1985 from kidney disease. Now, John William McCall, better known as Windy McCall, and he was nicknamed Windy not because he was from San Francisco, and not because he was a star pitcher for San Francisco for many years, or in San Francisco. He did play with the Junior Seals while growing up. He was actually signed by the Brooklyn Dodgers, but also got signed by Uncle Sam. Yes, the Marine Corps drafted him. So unfortunately for the Dodgers, they missed out on him. But once he got done going overseas and playing ball while fighting with the Marine Corps in World War II, he eventually was able to find his way into the Red Sox system. And that is actually where he got his nickname, Windy. Even though McCall was a pitcher, he fancied himself as a good hitter. So when he was with the Red Sox, he would talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk to Ted Williams. And Williams, who gave players a lot of nicknames, decided to call him Windy, and the name stuck. In fact, you never heard McCall by his birth name. He was often called Windy. And he would eventually couldn't make his way into the Red Sox rotation, would eventually find his way to New York with the Giants via trade, was part of the 1954 World Championship team, and followed the team to San Francisco, his hometown, in 1958. And after his career wrapped up in the minor leagues in 1959, he would work for the Beacons Van and Storage Company in San Francisco for 25 years. He was a salesman there. And an interesting point here, when the Giants had players who needed to make a move, they would give the sale to McCall to make. He actually helped Willie Mays move once upon a time. So a very interesting story there with Windy McCall, who is still alive and kicking, by the way. He is, how old is he now? 90, 93, I want to say. I think he just turned 93 a few months ago, which is just outstanding. Now, Bobby Hoffman, you know, for a guy who didn't have really much of a playing career to talk about, he was a utility player primarily with the New York Giants. He was a teammate of McCall's, actually, in the early 1950s, was part of that 1954 team as well. He was primarily a utility player. He was a favorite of Leo DeRocher to use in a pinch-hitting, pinch-run defensive replacement situation here. He was also a catcher at some points in time. Basically, he was the definition of utility man. Wherever you could move Bobby Hoffman, he would find a spot and fit in there. But he wasn't spectacular at anything. He was good at some things, not spectacular at anything. And by the time the early 60s roll around, his pro career is done. So he does what a lot of players do. He moves into the coaching realms and the management realms, and he is with the athletics system, moving his way up, and eventually becomes a base coach with the Athletics in 1966 and 67, their final 2 years in Kansas City. Now, in 1968, he becomes a base coach with the Washington Senators, eventually comes back to the Athletics in 1969-1970 when the team is in Oakland, and then he would get a coaching job in Cleveland in 1971 and 72. Now, what's interesting about his job in Cleveland was he wasn't just the third base coach, he was also the team's traveling secretary. In fact, he kind of split the secretary duties with the team trainer, Jim Warfield. Now, a lot of people thought, well, it's just the Indians being cheap. And yeah, that was part of it. But this would turn out to be a very positive development for Bobby Hoffman, because once he lost his job in Cleveland, Charlie Finley hires him back in Oakland in 1974. And he continues to be a coach for the A's, but he also has the double duties of travel secretary, a role which he would continue to have in the late 1970s. Eventually, Finley fires him. Well, who picks him up afterwards? George Steinbrenner. And he is the traveling secretary for the Yankees into the late 1980s. So even though he didn't have that spectacular career on the field, he was a world champion with the Giants in 54, was part of the Oakland A's when they won their World Series, their third consecutive World Series in 1974, and he was part of the Yankees after their World Series domination in the late 70s, but still a key part of that organization for about 10 years afterwards. And Bobby Hoffman could work with anybody. If you could work with and survive working with both Charlie Finley and George Steinbrenner, then you were pretty impressive. Now let's tell you the story about Ray Crone. This is an interesting story. A young pitcher who came up through the Braves system and had all sorts of upside to him, but he just wasn't able to crack that rotation. He couldn't be a steady starter with the Milwaukee Braves. And you look at the Braves rotation back in the mid to late 50s, Warren Spahn, Lou Burdett, Bob Boole, Gene Conley. You know, it was very hard to get in there and be more than just a spot reliever. So even though Ray Crone had some good talent and, you know, had a lot of upside, just couldn't catch on with the Braves. Eventually is traded to the New York Giants in 1957, a trade that Crone was never able to recover from. He was in the trade that brought Red Shandians to the Braves. That would turn out to be one of the final pieces the Braves needed to ultimately win the World Series in 57, win the National League pennant in 58. Well, Crone was pretty upset because he went from a pennant contender to a team that was clearly on the downfall in New York and then later San Francisco. Well, after the Giants move to 1958 and Crone moves with him, he's not doing much with the Giants. He's then bouncing around from one minor league team to the other. And in the early 1960s, his pro career ends. Well, he's retiring from baseball. He's out of baseball for a while, but gets back into the game in the early 70s as a scout, first with the Montreal Expos, later with the Baltimore Orioles, and then later on, he is with the San Diego Padres. Well, one player that he is scouting goes by the name of Kevin Towers. He was a pitcher, and Kevin Towers never made a big splash in the major leagues, but Kevin Towers became a scout and later the general manager of the Padres. He was hired in 1995, the architect of the 1998 National League pennant winning team. And unfortunately, sadly, Kevin Towers passed away from cancer not that long ago, just a few months ago. But Towers returned the favor to Chrome by hiring him as a scout through Towers' tenure in San Diego. And Crone's son, Ray Jr., by the way, has been a big league scout for many years, and at last check is a scout for the Arizona Diamondbacks. Crone, by the way, alive and well, too. He is, 87 years old, just turned 87 back in August. Johnny Schmitz, another talented lefty who had one hell of a curveball. And like I said, unfortunately, my particular card, even though it's a high number card, isn't quite worth as much because somebody wrote a number on the back. And it wasn't even his uniform number. Somebody just wrote the number 14 on the back of the card, unfortunately. Oh, well. Well, Johnny Schmitz, even though he had really good breaking stuff, he too, much like Ray Crone, just couldn't stick around with the club that brought him up to the big leagues. And he would bounce around from one team to another. And eventually his pro career would end in the, the late 1950s. And he would, after his pro career wrapped up, he became a greenskeeper in the Wausau, Wisconsin American League golf course. In fact, he was there for many, many years and still tried to keep pitching as well, playing for the semi-pro Wisconsin Valley League with the Wausau Bakers. Now, he wasn't just a greenskeeper at the Wausau American Legion Golf Course. He was also an outstanding golfer, and as many people in Wisconsin do, he was an excellent ice fisher as well. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2011, and his story is one of what could have been. You know, like I said, very talented, had a great slow curve, just could not, for whatever reason, find his stride when he was with the Boston Red Sox, and eventually bounced around from one team to another. Rudy Minarsin from North Vandergrift, Pennsylvania. He was very fortunate that the Phillies had a farm club there because that is how he was scouted. And after he served time in the Korean War, he would eventually get a pro career going through the Philadelphia Phillies. And eventually, he would make his way to the big leagues, joining Cincinnati in the mid-1950s, and was one of the many Red Legs, as we had that discussion a little earlier, was able to pitch for several seasons. Wasn't able to stick around in the big leagues past 1957. Eventually, playing in the minor leagues in the late 1950s, developed some arm problems as well. Also, developed a terrible knee injury too when he was in the military. I should say he didn't actually serve in Korea because just before his group was going to ship out to Korea, he had to play in a football game. And while he was running with the ball, he fractured his knee and his ACL. And of course, back in the 1950s, ACL surgery was not exactly as smooth as it is now. So a guy who had a lot of promise, you know, coming up in Pennsylvania and, you know, even in his time in the military, it all got derailed with those injuries, first to the knee. And of course, when you try, if you've ever had a knee injury, if you try to compensate for the knee injury, chances are you're going to throw something else out. And as a pitcher, even though he compensated and was able to get a few years in the big leagues, he ended up hurting a lot of other parts of his body. And finally, in 1958, I believe it was, his pro career wound down. Now, when he was done, he went back to Pennsylvania and took over his father's grocery store. If you've ever been to the Martin's Market in Vandergrift, Pennsylvania, well, that was Rudy Minarsin and his father before him running it. In fact, Rudy ran the store up until 1995. when he retired, and he passed away back in 2013. He was a big fan of the Pirates, of course, Vandergrift, just out of the shadows of Pittsburgh. I want to skip ahead to Chuck Deering here, who was actually our last card. Not a whole lot of information on Chuck Deering because he too, like Manarsson, had a very, very brief pro career. Started with the Cardinals in 1947, played with the Giants in 1952, pictured on his card with the Baltimore Orioles in 1956, and that was actually his last season in the major leagues. Don't have a lot more information here. He's an outfielder, also played some games at catcher, but all I know is that after his pro days, he went on to become a car dealership owner in Alton, Illinois, and that's something that he did for a very long time. He passed away at the age of 89 back in November of 2012. And lastly, probably the biggest card of this collection, and we've talked about this gentleman quite a bit, Del Crandall. You know, we were talking in our 1955 Top Show about Jim Hegan being not only the anchor behind home plate as the catcher for the Cleveland Indians, but a big reason why the Indians' pitching staff was so good in the late 40s and early 50s. Same thing with the Milwaukee Braves and Del Crandall, as I mentioned, Spahn and Buell and Burdett. You know, there's a reason why they had such an outstanding pitching staff. It's not just because of the collection of arms, but because you had a real good general in Del Crandall who was running the show. Actually made his major league debut at the age of 19. He was the fourth youngest player to play in the major leagues, the youngest starting catcher in baseball history when he did that in 1949. And after his 2 years in the military in the early 1950s, he would just become, just like I said, an anchor for the Braves. He would be the all-star catcher for them from 1953 to 1962 before winding down his career several years later as a player. But he got into broadcasting and he got into coaching. In fact, he would later coach, be the manager in Milwaukee. After finding his way up the pipeline in the Dodger system, having a successful stint in Albuquerque and later Evansville, he would become the manager of the Brewers heading into the 1972 season. And I had made a mistake in our video link. I said he was the first manager in Milwaukee Brewers history after the team left Seattle, and that is not true. He came in there in 1972 and had to be the manager of some very lean teams from 72 to 75, although he gets a lot of credit for molding another anchor all-star catcher, Darryl Porter, into position. And in fact, Porter was a long, long time successful story behind the plate for the Milwaukee Brewers. Now, even though he didn't find much success in Milwaukee, Crandall would go back into minor league coaching. He would be the interim manager for the Seattle Mariners in the mid-1980s and would then get into broadcasting as he was a color commentator for the White Sox in the mid to late 80s and the Brewers in the early 1990s. And Delmar Wesley Crandall, still alive and kicking to this day, a ripe 88 years old, and still one of the big keys to why baseball was successful with the Milwaukee Braves. Just like I said, with Jim Hegan and his effect on the Cleveland Indians pitching staff at about the same time, Del Crandall did the exact same thing for the Milwaukee Braves for many, many years. Many years. Well, a lot of great stories from a great set. Again, the 56 Tops set is one of my favorite, and you can argue that it is the best set that Tops ever put out. Certainly, I got a lot of good reasons to say that. And as I said earlier in the podcast, if you can get your hands on some of these cards, by all means, do it, because there's just so many great action shots. It's a great set. It's a great design, good layout, and you got a lot of star power. And if you're not too worried about condition, you can find some really good deals, not only on lots of common cards, but you can find some star players or semi-star players for maybe even a dollar, as fortunate as I was. So check out 56 Tops when you can. And again, with 56 Tops now in the books on Wax Ecstatic, we have a complete history of every major baseball card set that was released from 1950 up through 1993, all part of my personal collection. So if there's a particular set, if you're new to the show, and if there's a particular set you want to learn more about, check out our archives through any of our platforms, mainly Audio Boom, that's our home base, but also iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry, Spotify, Google Play. We've got basically the whole gamut covered. And, we've been able to patch that hole with the 55 and 56 top sets, and then also 52 and 53 tops and the early 50 Bowman sets. Now, I should correct myself. I don't have 51 tops, so that'll be my next job to find a 51 tops card to share with you. But suffice to say, we've expanded the collection here and have had a lot of discussions about some great sets along the way. Now, we've got another show coming your way in 2 weeks. Again, on Monday, September 29th, we'll put a poll out on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, let you select the pack that or packs that we open for our next show. We will base our show on those cards, the set in particular, and whatever we pull out of that pack. And that next show, the video break will come on Thursday, November 1st. The podcast will come on Friday, November 2nd. So make sure you be on the lookout for that program. My thanks again for everybody who listened in to this podcast. I really appreciate it. Again, if you would like to make a cash donation to keep things plugging along, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.